You know, there's many rooms to the mansion of KKFI. You know, we like to play great music, and we play blues and jazz because it's such an integral part of Kansas City history, and it's great music. And, you know, old classic rock and roll you hear nowhere else. But also on the public affairs side of it, we do have the flagship Democracy Now! And Counterspin and any number of others professionally produced. But we also have a number of locally produced public affairs programs. And it's real important that you show your support for those as well, because coming up is Jaws of Justice. It's one that has been running for a few years now, and it's all totally volunteer run. They find the stories, they find the people to interview, and they do this out of a love of trying to get the message out. So show your support to KKFI by supporting Democracy Now!, or right now by supporting Jaws of Justice, which is going to start momentarily, by giving us a call at 888-931-0901.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. Jaws of Justice Radio Hour will today feature host Keith Brownell talking with Hetty Hardin and Maria Miller, both members of Missouri Citizens United for Rehabilitation of Errants, CURE. We'll play the 420 Drug War News at the end of the program. Listeners, today is your opportunity to show your support for our program, Jaws of Justice. KKFI is listener-supported radio, and without you, we would not be able to bring you radio that you're interested to hear. Please call us now at 888-931-0901. Or log on to kkfi.org and click that donate button. Share your thoughts with us while you're online. We're here for you. Stay tuned to Keith Brownell.
In penal institutions, social distancing and taking other precautions is not always an option to avoid being infected. So today on our show, we will be examining the impact that the coronavirus is having on those who are incarcerated in our jails and prisons. Our guest will be Ms. Hetty Hardin, Chairman of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, also known as Missouri CURE, and Ms. Maria Miller, also a member of CURE and a local activist in St. Louis with other groups and organizations. Also in the studio with me is my co-host, Mr. Edward Pennington. My name is Keith Brownell. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. Good morning, ladies, and welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Okay, I think what I'll do is I'll give my co-host an opportunity to start off asking you a few questions, and I'll jump in here a little further along the line.
Okay. My first question was about testing. A lot of loved ones, I get calls from Licking and Cameron, well, Western. A lot of the guys are saying that even though they know it's there, they're not being tested. And I'm wondering, how do they determine who gets a test? And where is the testing starting at? And I haven't heard anything about
that. I can answer that. They've just started as of May 26th. They're going to test everyone, all the prisoners and the staff in all the prisons in Missouri. And they started with Charleston, where the outbreak has occurred. Right. And then they did Licking. And then the next, where they're going now, and then they'll announce from there what prisons come next.
Are they going to give us any information in regards to how many people are infected, or is that going to be confidential?
Well, I'm not really sure. They released information saying at Charleston they found like 3 new cases among staff, 4 new cases among prisoners, and 5 relapses among prisoners who had tested positive, then negative, and now positive again. They say it takes 2 negative tests to be cleared. And they're saying that the prisoners who have tested positive are being put in isolation and their cellies in quarantine. The guards are being put on leave.
Okay, that was my next question. I was wanting to know what is being done in regards to staff members who are infected and if they are being tested as well.
Yes, they're testing everyone.
Okay.
Every day I get letters, I get emails, and I get phone calls. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the emails give me a lot of good information, which I'm keeping track of from all the prisons. And I've been sending out notices to a list of people, including peer members, about what I hear from the prisoners in emails and phone calls and also letters.
What kind of information have you been getting, Maria?
Well, what I've been getting basically from Charleston, before they started the testing, the last time I heard that, before they started the testing, there were over 40 people confined in the facility that had tested positive. I believe they began doing the testing once a guard was tested positive. He came in and they found and tested him, because before then they were not doing any testing nor temperature. They just asked a series of questions, and if they answered yay or nay to the question, that would determine if they were able to work. So one of the guards tested positive. At that point, I believe it was like 7 to 10 people that were incarcerated that tested positive. Now, over that weekend, that happened like on a Saturday. By that Monday, there were 3 guards and like 17 people in the facility that tested. As of when they began the testing, there were almost 50 people incarcerated. And just like Andy said, they were putting them in quarantine and in isolation. I think they blocked out Housing Unit 5 in Charleston. In Licking, I'm not exactly sure how they, I'm pretty sure they did it the same way. I'm not sure which housing unit they blocked out. I believe Charleston and Licking were the first two to get tested, just like they were with the mask, because those were the prisons that had the people incarcerated that tested positive at the highest rate.
I haven't heard that about Licking. There, what the DOC is saying is that after all the testing at Licking, they haven't found anyone. I don't know if that's true, but that's what they're saying.
Somebody told me that yesterday, too, that they said that they didn't, after they finished their testing, they haven't had cases of people who were infected.
How long does it take for them to determine? Is it hours, days, or what, before they can determine a person is doesn't have it or does have it?
Well, I know that the National Guard has been working with them, and I think they do some of the testing, so they have actually been on site. So I'm sure that speeds it up, but it still takes a while with the whole facility being tested. So they did the first 2 prisons in 4 days. I don't know how long it took for them to get the results.
I don't think it's anything that requires to be sent to a lab. You probably get immediate results once you do the testing. They got a swab. They have to stick it all the way up in your nose or something and touch your brain or something like that.
They do, too. They do one in the mouth and one in the nose. But I don't think it's that immediate.
I believe it's within 48 hours. Those results come back, I know, within 72 hours, because, just an example, they're saying that Licking does not have any results. They get all those testing kits in 4 days. So for them to have those results back already, they would have to come back within 24 to 72 hours for the testing to, you know, the results to come in.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, that's how they're able to say, well, no, we don't, they don't have this. I mean, and this is maybe for a fish, but who is to say those numbers are given that are even correct? Because before they started the testing, they got on national news and said that they had X amount of people that were tested positive when that number was way higher. So one of my concerns is, are they even giving us the true numbers of these people that are being tested?
That's always been a concern when you talk in DLC.
Yeah.
But I do think that they're trying to contain it because it's in their interest as well. But the last numbers I heard from Licking was 45 prisoners and about 8 or 9 staff. And since the testing was completed, that would be apparently 54 prisoners and maybe 12 or 13 staff. But again, we don't know for sure.
Well, what about the problems of social distancing? Has anybody written you regarding that situation?
Yes, definitely. It's a problem in prison, obviously. You know that as well as I do, both of you guys. But
right.
It's different in different prisons how well they're following the guidelines. But some of the prisons are, well, they've canceled classes or they've reduced the class sizes. When they go to the chow hall, the tables apparently are set up for four people, and some of the prisons are having only two people at the tables. I think that one of the worst that I've heard from is Western Missouri in Cameron, where they're trying to go back to business as usual, and they're so crowded in the chow hall that it's hard to even find a place to sit. And in all the prisons, it's a problem when they go to rec because they get all jammed up in the sally port while they're being moved from one place to another. Apparently, it's hard to breathe in there, too, and so we know that just in prison itself, it's impossible to do social distancing completely.
Yes, exactly.
And especially in places where you have open dorms or large numbers of people in cells, and like at Farmington where they have the MOSOP testing, they're in beds that are 3 feet apart or less. So it's really impossible. I would believe that Farmington is going to have a lot of people, and they have people there that are older, that are sickly. It's bad.
Brad, I just got a letter, it was Friday, and this was coming out of Charleston. A guy, cellmate, tested positive. So, of course, they separated them, but this goes to the social distancing. You know, before this, take 14 days of quarantine, you know, for the short meal system or however. If you have someone in a cell with someone who's tested positive, it can easily contaminate them. And I do know someone that refused testing. And what they did was they put them in quarantine, which was housing unit 5. And when they put them over there, I guess they were upset. So they put them over there with no shoes, no mask, no blankets, no pillows. And his concern was they put them in a, you know, highly infected area, even though they're saying they're cleaning these areas, but they didn't use their safety equipment, and that could have very well infected him. And that's what also what the guy is saying, that his cellmate tested positive, but they had him in the cell with this man for days, so it's like impossible to separate these, you know, individuals. And then they're placing, like if you refuse the testing, they're placing you over in housing unit 5, which is contaminated, so if you don't have the virus, the germ is still dormant, you know?
What kind of protective equipment are they giving prisoners?
All they're giving them is masks, and the problem with that, the mask is that the guards who have the good masks are not wearing them. Almost none of them wear their masks. And that's where the virus is coming from. And prisoners eventually you see the guards not wearing masks, and they're not wearing them either, a lot of them. So that's a real serious problem. But at Charleston, supposedly the people who have tested positive are being put in isolation, and the cellies are put in quarantine. I got a email from a guy at Charleston who his housing unit is in quarantine right now. And he says, we've been locked down in our cells since Tuesday, June 2nd. We've not been out of our cell for any reason whatsoever. No showers, no phones, nothing. Part of the preaching done here is the importance of remaining clean, not only your body, but also your clothes and your cell. We cannot clean, sweep, mop, wipe down, use disinfectant, or even get to the hand sanitizer, let alone take a shower. Again, different correctional officers are in and out of our wing, different med pass people, etc. This exposes a greater number of people, which is not necessary. They even bring in an offender to collect trash. Why not keep it all in-house or in-wing? Why expose outsiders and let them go to other housing units or places in the prison? As of today, no official has come in and done any type of a question and answer period. So we yell out to the COs serving meals and ask our questions, and we're told they don't know or what they think, but no solid answers.
And that's one of my, when this first started, when they stopped the visits back in March, that was one of my main issues with what made me want to do something with this virus, you know, in the pandemic. They stopped business the middle of March. So no outsiders to get into the prison. So that means the only way that they can get this virus, it was contracted through a guard. And it really burned me up that, as Hedy said, they weren't even wearing masks. I'm not sure if they're wearing the masks now, but they were not wearing these masks. They weren't even testing. They weren't even taking the temperature. So these guards were allowed to come to work and possibly infect these individuals incarcerated, which was just horrible to me, considering you know that this was a deadly virus. You know that you don't have the proper help, and you did not properly test these guards before you allowed them to come into these prisons. And now these people are being infected. And I did just reach out to the lady's girlfriend up at your at the Licking. There were two confirmed cases of COVID-19 when they finished doing the testing at Licking. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're not being honest about
that. They're not being forthright about it.
And how long?
It just makes me want to talk.
How long has this restricted visiting been going on?
Since March 6th or something.
And they're not allowing any visitors into the institution to have contact with their family members.
No video visits, no visits.
Not even contact visits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I understand.
The only one that was able to bring that, the only people that were able to bring that in would be the staff. And I just confirmed that with Licking, those two positive cases came after the testing was done last week. So it's just all crazy.
And then the testing itself, I've heard that they're not always accurate. So that, and the fact is that you can test everybody today and some of the people will change tomorrow. Some who weren't tested, who weren't positive, may be positive the next day. So, it's better to test than not to test, but it's not a cure-all. Yeah,
right. That was going to be my next question. Okay, you mentioned something about two negatives or two positives. So that means the people have to be tested, what, three times before they're absolutely sure whether they have it or not?
If they test negative once, they have to, I guess they wait a while and then they test them again. And if they're negative again, then they're considered negative, period.
Right.
But, it's only as effective as, the day it's done for you.
Well,
yeah. And then not all the tests are accurate.
I heard,
just the way it is.
I heard one of y'all make a comment a while ago about they giving the guards a good mask. And what's the difference between the masks that the guards are being given and the masks that are being given to the prisoners?
The guards are getting the masks that the hospitals get. And the prisoners are getting masks that were made at the prison out of old bed sheets. And they're so thin you can see through them. Mm-hmm. And when you wash them, they a lot of times tear up. Mm-hmm.
And this was, though, I found an article last week. I don't know if I sent you all this. It was, and if I didn't have to send it to you or don't, it was the inmates, you remember when they had the inmates making the masks? So these inmates right. were working from dusk to dawn. And what stuck out to me when I looked at this article is not one of those people that were making the masks had on masks or gloves. So just imagine. And I sent it to you all phone.
Pardon me?
Did I send that to your phone, Keith?
I don't know. I have to look back through it.
Yeah, and none of these people, I'm going to say it was maybe six of them. None of these people had on gloves, masks, you don't see any sanitizer. So they could have easily coughed on them. I'm not saying purposely, but just, we have to cough. We can't control it. It comes out. But none of these people had on masks or gloves, but you're shipping these out to all the prisons. That was just a pure safety breach to me, considering we're trying to control this, control it.
At the women's prison in Vandalia, they were given out masks, and they were told, before you use them, you need to wash them. And when they washed them, a lot of them just fell apart.
Of course, they're not giving out any second masks if something happens.
They're supposed to be giving two masks to each prisoner. In most cases, I think they are. But when the women asked, you know, if they'd replace the ones that tore up, they said no. Also, the women who work in the sewing factory at Vandalia are stuck right next to each other, especially when they have to stand for count. They're like shoulder to shoulder. So they feel, not just there, but all over, they feel like the DOC doesn't care about them. And especially with the guards not wearing their masks.
Are there any prisoners making complaints to the CDC? Because there are guidelines that have been issued that they have to make an effort to try to comply with. And they can't just tell these people.
What's the CDC?
The CDC, the Center for Disease Control.
Oh, CDC. Oh, I really don't know. But I know prisoners are complaining to everywhere they can think of. So I've actually sent some of their letters to Ann Treeside just to make sure she gets the information. And a couple of times I sent information that she said she would check into it. And at least one time she took action right away. Another time, she said that she and Jeff Norman, who's the new director of adult institutions, would check into it. But then I saw a memo from Jeff Norman saying this was about the fact that they weren't getting enough soap, and that's a major problem. People that can't afford to buy soap from the canteen have to rely on what's given to them, and they get like one hotel-sized bar of soap a week.
Yeah.
And when I told her about that, after she had sent a memo telling everybody to wash their hands frequently and thoroughly, and she said she'd look into it, then there was a message to the prisoners from Jeff Norman saying that the soap would be distributed as it has been, and if they needed more, they should see a caseworker, which is ridiculous because they can't even see caseworkers since this virus thing started.
Before we go off the air, I'd like to thank both of you for participating in this broadcast today. And we hope that all the efforts that are being put forth to try to mobilize people and get them interested in becoming involved in this struggle that we have to engage in, we hope that this will inspire somebody to get involved. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I want to thank Keith Brownell for a wonderful interview, a very, very topical interview of what's going on. We're going to take a quick break here to encourage you to support KKFI during our pledge drive. And I believe we have a champions match, if I'm not mistaken. And Mr. Bill Sundahl, could you tell us about it, please?
I would be happy to. Thank you so much. Thanks to Keith for his work in producing great content, great stories, and telling the stories that need to be told. That's what we do here at KKFI. And I would also like to thank Jeff Humfeld, who is our champion right now. So I started the timer on a 7-minute clock to match $200 that Jeff has thrown down as a challenge right now. So I started a minute. It's 6.5 minutes, I guess, right now, to dial 888-931-0901 or go online at kkfi.org. And, of course, Jeff Humfeld started Jaws of Justice well over a decade ago and has covered so many important stories. And I know that we're joined by Terry Wilkie along with Bill Claus and myself. And you guys have a lot more information about Jeff than I do. So I'm going to defer to your wisdom. And yeah, I'm just curious if you could tell us a little bit about Jeff and how he started Jaws of Justice.
Yeah, Jeff and I go back a long time. This is Bill Claus, and I'm in the studio here with Terry Wilkie. We are socially distanced apart. We're appropriately masked. But, call in now. Get your money doubled by showing your support for Jaws of Justice. And Jeff Humfeld and I grew up in the labor movement. He was with the Carpenters Union, and he was an activist. And whenever we were on the rally or whatever, a demonstration, he was always out there. But he also was one of the people that worked at the beginning of Heartland Labor Forum. We go back to Heartland Labor Forum, which started in 1989, and we were both volunteers for that for many years. And Jeff saw a need at KKFI to deal with issues of involving the justice system, if you will, and what a timely thing that has turned out to be. And he had a couple of motives for doing that. Number one, covering the issues that need to be covered, and he knew that as far as black lives are concerned, that they were the ones most affected by this, and he was able to recruit a number of volunteers, just like Keith Brownell that you just heard, from the community to come in and help tell these stories. So he has helped develop a wonderful program, and along with that also is Teresa Wilkie, who has worked on that program. I'll let her say a few words after I tell you that you can double your money now by giving us a call at 888-931-0901 or go to kkfi.org so you can show your support during this champions match and double your money. Anyway, tell us anything you want to about Jaws of Justice and how long you've been with it and anything you want to say about Jeff.
I want to say good morning to Jeff. Thank you for putting your money down. Listeners, this is the best dollar you're going to spend today. If you're like me and you like to get good value for your money, call us now, 888-931-0901. We're all volunteers here doing this absolutely out of the joy of being programmers that are giving you the true stories of people who are involved with the criminal justice system and with economic injustice, political injustice in general. Monday after Monday, 9 to 10 o'clock, we bring you stories that you're interested to hear. We try to give a fair report on what has happened to people. We try to hear all sides of the story. And it's great radio. This comes to you through your airwaves at no charge to you. But like all things, there's a charge. So if you call and give us any amount of money, even a dollar, but $10 a month, I'm a sustained giver, you can call 888-931-0901. And if you said, I want to give $10 a month, in a year, you're going to help us meet that challenge. Otherwise, Jeff, who, as we've described, is a good practical guy, he'll take that money and go someplace else with it. So this
he'll
is your
misspend
chance.
It somehow.
This is your chance, and it's worth every penny. That's back to what I'm saying about you get good value for this. We try very hard to give you good radio, and call us. You can go online, kkfi.org. We have nice people in the phone room. This is an easy, good chance to participate with us. Show us your support. We know you're listening. We know every Monday you're listening. So call us now.
Thank you, Terry. This is Bill Sundahl. I couldn't agree more with what she just said, that this is an important piece of KKFI's programming, that Jaws of Justice Monday after Monday is working to help people and educate all of us. One story that sticks out in my mind, and it came back to me this morning. I was watching one of the local news stations before I came in, and there pops up on my screen Ricky Kidd, and they were interviewing Ricky about the movement that's going on right now and social injustice, as he is an exoneree, and they had under his name Ricky Kidd exoneree, and Ricky told me in this very studio one day that the reason he's out of prison is because of Jaws of Justice telling his story the first time, that other people picked up on it eventually, and it became known across. It was basically the media that told the story and then forced the justice system to sort of look backwards and go, oh, yes, we did do something wrong and put this gentleman in prison for years incorrectly. So I know that every time I see or hear Ricky's name, I think of Jaws of Justice, because it really, because he told me that that's the reason he, that his story really started to pick up traction, was because of the coverage it got here at KKFI. So thank you, Jeff Humfeld and the crew at Jaws of Justice for helping right just one wrong. There's a lot more out there, of course. So if that's important to you, if that this type of programming and these type of stories getting told is important, then right now is a perfect time to double your gift to KKFI, thanks to our generous champion, Jeff Humfeld, who, of course, created Jaws of Justice years ago. And that was the timer on the Champions match. I really appreciate everyone listening. And Bill and Terry, if you have anything else to say, I would, go for it. 888-931-0901 to show your support for KKFI and Jaws of Justice.
Yes, go to our archive at www.kkfi.org. The Jaws of Justice page. We've got 41 pages that you can look through to find interesting shows. Our history is fabulous. And we do this on a dime, and we need your dimes. Call us now, 888-931-0901.
Okay, we're going to be going back to Jaws of Justice. We have the calendar of events coming up. We have a Community Voices dealing with prison reentry, and then a special feature. And thank you for supporting us. Give us a call, 888-931-0901.
Now the calendar for the week of June 8th. In compliance with the latest version of Mayor Lucas' emergency order, certain business activities may resume while ensuring necessary public health measures remain in place. See the facts at kcmo.gov. Corey's Network will have their weekly meeting with a survivors workshop, Moving Forward 2, on Monday, June 8th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, the City House, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Independence, Missouri. The church is east of the Hy-Vee on 40 Highway. Corey's Network asks us to please join their weekly meetings to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop, not a grief group. Please include only those individuals mature enough in age to deal with issues being covered during the meeting. Check their website, coreysnetwork.org, or phone 816-866-7868. Your Fellow Americans documentary and discussion series is Monday, 6-8 at 6:30 p.m. in the Hellsburg Auditorium at the Central Library, 14 West 10th, Kansas City, Missouri. We'll ponder the question, who are your fellow Americans? We want you to feel encouraged to discuss the sensitive subjects of racism, prejudice, and immigration in calm conversation. Go to kclibrary.org. You can also go online. Monday, June 8th, Kansas City, Kansas Masked Physically Distant Protest will be 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Unified Government, 701 North 7th Street, Kansas City, Kansas. They say the community has demanded change for years. Now is the time for fundamental rethinking of policing in Kansas City, Kansas, and Wyandotte County. You can show up to make your voices heard. Tuesday and Thursday, June 9th and 11th, from 4 to 7 p.m., Moore Square will be having a phone bank about the Medicaid expansion on the Missouri August ballot. Moore Square has built a strong phone outreach system, and there's potential to engage thousands and thousands of voters. Your team, organization, or congregation can host its own remote phone bank. Contact Gary at mooresquare.org to learn more. On Wednesday, June 10th at 11 a.m., there'll be a rally for prosecutor accountability outside the courthouse at 415 East 12th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Speakers include Kansas City Freedom Project, Real Justice Network, Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, family members impacted by police violence in Kansas City, and others. More info is on KC Freedom Project's Facebook page. MISD advocacy and support sessions are usually Saturday, 13th of June, noon to 2 p.m. at PlexPod, Westport Commons Meeting Room, Annex A, 300 East 39th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Call 816-337-5876 or email misdadvocacy@gmail.com for more information. The Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty statewide annual meeting is in Columbia on Saturday, June 13th. That will be virtual, so attend. No driving necessary. More information on madpmo.org. Thursday, June 11th, Johnson County and Wyandotte County Moms Demand Action virtual meeting, 6:30. Go to momsdemandaction.org to receive the dial-in instructions for the virtual meeting. Discuss ways to end gun violence, and the meeting will be joined by Gun Sense Champion and 3rd Congressional District Representative Sharice Davids. Willow Domestic Violence Center 24-hour hotline is 785-843-3333. A list of services, meals, and hotlines specific to sheltering are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That's updated daily. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org, as well as the Jaws of Justice Facebook page. We want to thank all our volunteers today. Stay safe. Practice physical distancing. Wash your hands. Please listen to Jaws of Justice next week.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only, and not necessarily those of Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
Hello, my name is Gene Ronsick, and I am speaking to you today as the Volunteer Program Coordinator for the Kansas City Crime Commission's Mentoring to Excel program. Our aim is to successfully transition individuals who are released from an incarceration setting back into our community as productive citizens. The current program is a product of a coalition of 3 separate community support organizations: the Kansas City Metropolitan Crimes Commission's Second Chance Program, the Johnson County Department of Corrections Adult Residential Center, and Res Reentry, a local impact ministry of the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection. Together, these 3 organizations collaborate to ensure that all mentors have the tools, support, and access to community service they might need for their mentees, and that all mentees are afforded the maximum opportunity to succeed in their reentry journey back into the community. The Mentoring to Excel program was initiated in the spring of 2015, and the first match was made in August of that year. So the program has been continuously up and running for over 4 years now. It provides mentors to assist mentees with employment and education goals, locating safe and affordable housing, obtaining rehabilitation and substance abuse treatment assistance, navigating local government agencies, nonprofit support, and faith-based assistance to secure eligible benefits and resources, encouraging healthy and productive social and leisure time activities and spiritual needs if requested, and finally, providing an example of how to live a normal, productive life outside the criminal justice system. Mentoring to Excel is a team sport and requires conscious coordination between and among its mentors, correction department staff, and myself. Some of the program's operational processes and requirements include: all participants and mentors and mentees must be volunteers. Each volunteer, mentor, and mentee is asked to commit to a year-long relationship, meeting for about an hour every 2 weeks. Each mentee is interviewed, then the mentor and mentee are paired via match meeting. Each subsequent meeting between the mentor and mentee must be documented with a short report completed by the mentor and emailed to key staff. The Mentoring to Excel program has interviewed and made over 200 mentor-mentee matches and has trained over 100 mentors. You may ask yourself, why mentor citizens who are being released from incarceration? The successful transition back into the community and workforce can be extremely difficult without some assistance to help ease the frustration inherent in the process. Mentoring appears to be the most effective way for people with pre-existing difficulties to make the best use of their own human capital and realize positive change. Mentoring can help reduce recidivism in many ways, among them providing a one-on-one interaction to achieve personalized learning and growth goals, catering to individual needs, processing real-life issues, and supporting personal development and achievement of positive goals. The bottom line is mentoring works. If you think you might be interested in becoming a mentor, or if you've recently been released from incarceration and think that you might be in need of a mentor, please contact me, Gene Ronsick, at 913-579-7000. 6674. Thank you.
Louisiana activists are battling to free Louisiana prisoners from what they call the COVID-19 death trap. Two of them spoke to the Black is Back Coalition's recent national teleconference. Here's Belinda Parker Brown of Louisiana United International.
Jim Crowism is alive and well here in the state of Louisiana. Institutional racism is alive and well here in the state of Louisiana. And you know, we had the war on drugs, and Louisiana took the lead and became the highlight over every other country that massively incarcerated people more than anywhere else in the world with the war on drugs. Then after that, we had Katrina. Katrina told the story while the whole world was watching us here in Louisiana, how bad we were being treated as Black people. Now we got the COVID-19. It's a death sentence on Black people here in the state of Louisiana. In our prisons and jails, it is horrific. And people are dying inside of these jails because there is a lack of any type of administrative remedies. They are covering up the real truth. We just had a wife call me and said that her husband died in the prison, and they did not even notify her. And they then buried him on the prison grounds without her even having the opportunity to know about the death of her husband. We got jails packed, people packed inside of these hellhole jails like sardines on top of each other. And there is no way that they can practice social distancing. There is no way possible that they can get the proper medical treatment and attention that they need because they're sick. We just had a situation where the warden died from the COVID-19. The medical director have died from the COVID-19. In one of the facilities, the whole kitchen trustee staff was infected. Now, the inmates that are in the jail are striking because they're afraid to eat the food because it was contaminated.
Here's attorney Zena Crenshaw-Logal.
Our fight is against the colonial virus and the death chambers that it has turned the Louisiana detention centers and the jails and prisons into. That fight is based on fact and is based on law. The government reports on what is happening in Louisiana in their detention centers and jails and prisons are inconsistent with what people confined in those facilities are telling their family members, as Ms. Belinda indicated. So at this point, the government reports are unreliable, and we have reason to believe that everyone incarcerated in the state of Louisiana is at risk of dying of COVID-19 infections, and that means thousands of Black people may get sick or die in captivity.
That was Belinda Parker Brown and Zena Crenshaw-Logal, both of Louisiana United International. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Recently, the Global Commission on Drugs released a major report. This is Louise Arbour, former High Commissioner for Human Rights from Canada.
When you have bad laws, laws that are misguided, hugely unpopular, and basically not respected by a large number of the population, as was the case in Canada, and as is the case in many parts of the world with respect to criminalization of personal use of drugs, two things happen. First, it erodes the respect for the rule of law more broadly. Because the minute people see that some laws are not worth obeying, it undermines the confidence that we must, that it's in everybody's interest that everybody obeys the law. So it has this pernicious effect on countries that are governed by the rule of law. It's very bad. And it was the case, I think, with respect to personal consumption of marijuana, widely disregarded prohibition, despite the fact that some of the penalties were unduly harsh. That brings me to unduly harsh penalties. As soon as Canada adopted a Charter of Rights and Freedoms in 1982, one of the first cases that came to the court where the laws were challenged was the mandatory minimum 7-year sentence for importing narcotics, which could include importing one joint of marijuana. A lot of the conversation was, well, it doesn't matter if the law is too harsh. Either prosecutors will not use it, they'll bypass it, or judges will find a way. This again instills a culture of non-compliance, which is not good. You want laws that are just, that are fair, that are perceived as such, and then that are applied fairly and equitably. So I think what we've seen the judiciary, and not just the defense counsel, prosecutors, police officers, we've seen throughout the system a slow resistance to bad laws. And that's not good. I mean, it's good for the person who escapes this unfair punishment, but it's very corrosive for legal systems.
Okay, the video that the commission released features the words of 6 of these world leaders, and the report that they issued has 90-plus pages, which outlines the need to end this eternal war on drugs. You can link to both the report and the video by going to the May 27 edition of Cultural Baggage. It's out there on our website. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.